Okay, we will start. We are recording our personal stories from working in South Carolina. And I'm reading this thing as I do it. Okay, the date, today's date is October 1st, 19... October 2nd, thank you. 2015, and it is 11:50 a.m. There is a sign-up sheet going around. The recorder would appreciate that everyone state their name before speaking. I realize that's a challenge, but do your best to do that. And to... it says, ask for a volunteer to keep time with a chime. Does anyone have a chime?
I do.
Okay. Okay, we're going to start with going around the room with your name and where you worked in the summer of 1965. We have 45 minutes to briefly outline our thoughts on the topic.
Yeah, that doesn't say what the topic is.
Yeah, I think Bruce printed these out from someplace. They're from San Francisco. Okay, please stay on topic without digression into other areas. Yeah. Okay.
I have a feeling
sharing our stories.
That there was something that was in the program about topics for the different sessions.
Sessions, yes. The primary topic in this session is us, frankly, and what we did, who we are, and what we did. And Bill, would you like to begin?
Oh. Well, can I just break rule three right away and say that did anybody else remember Richard Miles, the Voter Education Project? He was the guy who went all around South Carolina and was helping us with voter registration stuff. Anyway, he became an ambassador in Bulgaria, etc.
Okay. It's important to start with your name, whatever.
Bill Trainer. Thank you, Tom. Bill Trainer. We just talked about the South Carolina stuff, right?
We're just talking about South Carolina stuff. Right?
So I had been...
Bill, if you look at the instructions, we go once around, name and where we were, 15 seconds.
Oh, 15 seconds, yeah. Bill Trainer, Newberry County, South Carolina, period.
Sherry Holbrook Lobitas, Berkeley County, South Carolina, period.
Tom Rothschild, Newberry County, South Carolina.
Ray Nelson, Charleston, South Carolina.
Bruce Miroff, Charleston County, South Carolina.
Joe Freeman, Newberry County, South Carolina. Okay, now tell us how you happened to end up in South Carolina. Give me your scope story.
Yeah.
Your pre-scope story.
I've been working for Jose for a couple of months.
You can give your name.
Bill Trainer. Thank you. Working for Jose for a couple of months. And I had been in jail in Crawfordsville for 10 days with Bill, with Bob Byrd and other people, etc. One of my brothers was getting married and I left, so I actually missed the orientation. And I came back the day after it was over. So Jose put me in charge. I was on the staff by then, put me in charge of we were a pickup crew, let's put it that way. Tom and Joe and I, and he put four or five of us together and sent us off to Newberry, which frankly I couldn't find in a map at the time. And then off we went and fell into the arms, lucky us, of Mrs. Turner, who really made the project in so many ways. And we were there for 2 months, something like that, including the first day of voter registration under the Voting Rights Act.
Okay, Sherry. After Selma, when Dr. King asked for students from the North, I volunteered.
Tom.
And how did you end up in Berkeley County?
I was assigned.
Okay. You told me a story once about how the Berkeley County had not been on the list and...
Martha Prela Simmons, who is where we lived in Berkeley County, had asked for 30 workers. She got zero. But I think there were 9 originally in Charleston. And when she found out there were workers in Charleston, she put on her church hat and she went down ready for war. And the next day, 4 of us.
And when she said, when she went down, did she go to Charleston or did she go to
Charleston?
Atlanta, okay. So you originally were assigned to Charleston.
Yes.
Yes. So you went with a group to Charleston and were kidnapped.
Then I went home. We escaped.
Okay. Okay, go ahead. Finish this.
Oh, and then I was supposed to say how I got there, right?
Yes, yes.
That's how I got there.
Okay.
I never left. I mean, I was there for the whole time.
Okay, so my name is Tom Rothschild. I was at the University of Michigan. There was no project at the University of Michigan. There was no group. But I had volunteered, and I was accepted. I purchased a car with my own money for the, which has its own story, but maybe that'll come later. And I used that to drive down to Atlanta for the registration. And then, as Bill said a few minutes ago, we were kind of a pickup group that was assigned to Newberry County, where we fell into the arms of Mrs. Turner, who guided us through and was a lot of the heart of the project. And that's where I was for the whole time. And I think we all traveled in my car from Atlanta because we had a car of our own, so to speak.
Was it just your car? It was the only car.
It was, exactly. It was both my car and the only car. It was an interesting car because it was the last Studebaker ever made. Which was one of the things that had made it cheap enough for me to buy. Even as a used car, that was one of the things that made it cheap enough for me to buy. So I think that's all we're doing on this round.
Well, we gotta finish the course.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, that's where I was for the summer.
Ray Nelson.
Yeah.
I was recruited in Berkeley on the campus and came to Atlanta with four of us in a Volkswagen Bug. And we were assigned to Charleston, South Carolina. I spent several weeks there, but it was a situation that was not as productive as we'd hoped it would be. So I spent a few days in the south and in the islands with Bruce and for a time we were. And then beyond, after that, we went to We were the second wave, I suppose, that went to Pineville, went up to Berkeley County, and we that's where I ended up. I was drafted in late August, so that put an end to my involvement at the time.
Bruce Miroff, like Ray, I was recruited from the Berkeley campus. I was an undergraduate. 7 of us traveled across country in 2 cars. Some were from elsewhere in Northern California than from Berkeley. We were assigned to Charleston County. It was not a good situation. And John Allen and I, John's arriving tonight, John Allen and I decided there was a minister on James Island in the Sea Islands who asked for some people. And so the two of us went out there. And there was also an African-American guy named Joe from Charleston who worked with us every day for about the first half of our time there. And so we spent about 7-8 weeks organizing James Island on voter registration.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Joe Freeman, I don't think I was recruited. Everyone else seems to have been recruited, but I don't feel like I was recruited.
No, I was not recruited. Tom Rothschild. I was a volunteer. I was not recruited.
Okay. I had been involved in the Bay Area Civil Rights Movement beginning in September of 1963. And I was arrested twice in the spring of 64. And I, frankly, planned on going to Freedom Summer, but one of my trials was scheduled for July. Sort of wiped that idea out. So after my trial was over, I hitchhiked to Atlantic City, New Jersey for the vigil outside the Democratic Convention. And then I came back, and lo and behold, we started the free speech movement, much to our surprise. Became my third arrest of the year. So I had every expectation of going south for summer of 65. I just assumed there would be a summer project, naive soul that I was. Just a matter of which one. And the reason I ended up with SCOPE is I actually applied for CORE, SNCC, and SCOPE. And the reason I ended up with SCOPE is because one of my roommate's boyfriends had gone to Mississippi summer. He came back in the fall, and he did not have very good things to say about SNCC. And he basically said that they were on an anti-white kick, that they were blaming all the white volunteers for their anger at the white Mississippians, and that although he didn't know anything about SCLC or SCOPE, he said it's got to be the better choice. So that's why I opted to go with SCOPE rather than any of the others. There was, I think most of us heard about it through Stiles Hall, which was the YMCA, which is where things happened that were politically necessary. And we, in fact, did have a orientation meeting in Stiles Hall, I believe in late May or early June, in which people were paired off with cars and rides and so on. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you want to look at it, I could not participate in the ride sharing because Berkeley's graduation was June, I think it was on the Saturday before orientation started. And my mother wanted to see me go through the graduation ceremony, and I wanted her signature on the parental consent form. Let's just say we both got what we wanted. So I went down to L.A. and called the Western office, and somehow they found someone else driving to Atlanta. So I got a ride. I don't even know who I rode with. But I missed all of orientation. So I probably got there just in time to get into your car to go to Newbury. Since it did take me a couple days to do all of that. So I assume that that's how I ended up in Newbury. It's some person figured, oh, she's from Berkeley. Well, put her with the other Berkeley people. So I don't know this. I just assume that that's what was going on. Does anyone else know how you ended up in Charleston or Newbury? You know how.
Well,
you
Charleston was Bruce Maroff. Esau Jenkins was a longtime civil rights activist. Yeah. Was doing voter registration back in the 40s in Charleston County. And I think he requested people to come to Charleston County.
Okay, but did he? But why the Berkeley people?
And that I don't know. We just, the last day of orientation, we were just told, you're going to Charleston County. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We were, you know, young, and they were going. We were going where the people told us.
Okay.
We didn't know why.
No, because I know that some scopers actually chose their counties.
Really?
Yes, yes. And I didn't. Well, and I'm guessing none of you did either.
Bill Traynor. Because I had gone on the staff and hadn't been around, so I definitely wasn't inner circle, but I was like a couple rings out. But I wasn't like one of the newbies, you know. Mm-hmm. When I got back from my brother's wedding in Providence, then Jose basically said to me, "I got some people out of him. He didn't pictures out of him, quote, but people I don't know what to do with. Well, just give them to you and go to." To Newbury. I don't think there was any, those of us who knew Jose can imagine, I don't think there was any more rhyme or reason to it than that. Because that's how we operate.
That's how you operate. So he just gave us to, picked the orphans and gave us
right.
to you.
Right, but he was smart enough to pick somebody who had a car.
Well, that was Tom Rothschild. That was probably the practical part. I certainly had not. I felt I was coming as a volunteer and would go wherever it was felt I ought to go, and not try to choose something that I wouldn't have known anyway what criteria to use or where to choose or anything else. That wouldn't have made sense for me to choose, and so I think that exactly, more or less as Bill said, okay, here's a place that needs people. I don't have people for it yet. Here's a car that can, as a practical question, that can get people there. So you with your car and the other people that seem like they ought to be there should go as a group. And Bill could be like the senior person, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think that on the other side of the equation, I'm sure that Mrs. Turner was like bugging whoever back in Atlanta to get people
there. Yeah.
She was sort of the magnet that pulled us in. Bill Turner.
Let's do a round on the local leadership. Mrs. Turner and Isa Jenkins and Priolo and...
Isa Jenkins,
okay. Well, there's someone in Charleston somewhere.
Who are you?
Huh?
Start your round. Each statement.
Joe Freeman. You're right. I need to obey the rules. You're absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Okay. And those of you who went to Charleston, give some thought to who that person in Charleston was, because there had to be someone there before you separated out to the other
right.
places.
Bruce Merrill. Well, I actually read in one of the books on civil rights movement, Esau Jenkins and Septima Clark, who was a very famous civil rights educator, started a education center on John's Island. And so this had been a kind of very important regional place for the movement for a long time. So, and Septima was, I think, maybe director of education, wasn't she, for...
We talk about Frogmore.
What?
Frogmore?
No, this is on John's Island. But I don't know if she was still there, but she'd been one of the people who started it. But she was quite a well-known person. And so that was, you know, there was a well-established kind of area in Charleston County on John's Island. So I think that was, Esau had some kind of stature probably in terms of...
So you didn't go to Charleston, the city?
We did initially. And that was a disaster. And that's where the groups kind of on their own decided to move out and find places where somebody was interested, where we felt we could do some productive work. And it was, I know certainly the James Island, we had a great time and felt very successful. And so it was a good move to get out of the city of Charleston.
Yeah, well, Joe Freeman, since you went to the Charleston, the city first, do you know who brought you there or who you stayed with?
I remember we stayed with a woman named Albertha Shears, but again, it was Esau. Esau had two businesses in the city of Charleston. He had an adjoining tavern and motel. And he was probably in his 60s by that time. So I assume it was all basically that he was the man that was responsible for everything.
Well, Charleston had an interesting...
Right, Nelson.
Charleston had an interesting... Esau Jenkins was in charge of our project, and one who brought us to Charleston. But Charleston, as Bruce has pointed out, I mean, Esau Jenkins had his locus of influence, his sphere of influence was in the islands. Although he had a business and was a SCLC, I suppose, representative in Charleston, they had very little influence there. We had to depend mostly on NAACP people who were deeply established in Charleston. And I believe the name was Blake. I think they had a young leader and a kind of young Turk leadership and of course the old crowd that was involved with some friction there. But we had to depend essentially on Blake for our volunteers. We had no access to young people, and Esau Jenkins had little influence in Charleston. So we depended on these people, and they had conflicting interests. Essentially, the NAACP really wanted a court case, and from the very moment we had gotten there, they wanted us to go to Eddystone Island and go sit on the beach until we were arrested, and that would bring a case that they could take to appeals court to appeal a law that closed the beach years before. Mm-hmm. And so that was their strategy, was to use these guys to get something in the appeal system. And we were resisting that because Esau Jenkins' strategy was to keep people on the street as much as possible. And it says SCLC, it said no arrests this summer. We didn't want that to happen. And we've had that kind of tension going on. And we depended on one, and we're trying to walk the line with the other. And what of course, what happened, you know, that really was not a very productive situation, but some of us stayed until, I guess we were kind of ambushed. Well, finally, we were sort of ambushed and invited to go for a 4th of July outing on the beach. Okay, trapped. You know, we either had to say no or yes. And if we said no, I felt like we were just through in Charleston anyway.
Joe Freeman, how long were you in Charleston before you...
Really, until July 4th.
Until July 4th.
Or until shortly after July 4th. We were arrested on the 4th of July.
Ah.
And it was kind of a... it was kind of an exit possibility for us. After that we went up to Glanville, but it was kind of a way to get out without under cover of the controversy they raised, because we really were in an impossible situation. We couldn't satisfy both, and the arrest, we felt like, well, okay, we've done what the NAACP wanted us to do. They have what they wanted from us, and now we can do more. We can do something else elsewhere. So that was our cue to get out of town.
Okay, Sherry, how long were you in Charleston?
4 days, and I can remember the first day canvassing. But then the next 3 days, we sat in the church waiting for somebody to give us an assignment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there was that conflict between the NAACP and the SCLC. We were going nowhere. So when we were sent to Pineville, it was like, maybe now we'll be useful.
Mm-hmm.
And we were.
Okay.
And the organization, Mrs. Prelo Simmons, excuse me, Martha Prelo Simmons, had been the leader of the Berkeley County Improvement Association or something like that. And she'd been very active in providing lunches for kids at school, and she had a small daycare center, and she had been very active by herself with one or two of the local people. There were David Fashion and Fortune Haskell were NAACP presidents, but they were a little bit farther out, so that we didn't see a lot of them. But Mrs. Simmons was a mover and shaker and had been for quite some time. And when we arrived, she was ready. She knew exactly where we were going and exactly what we were going to do. And made sure that we did it. And this is Sherry. That is it.
Ray, you said you went to Pineville? I thought you went to the island.
We did. I did. For several days, I was there with Bruce and John.
Okay.
And we did a little bit of canvassing on the island, and I remember spending a night or two in his in the education center there.
And then you left and went to Pineville?
No, we went back to Charleston at that time, because I think, we were back in Charleston when this on the 4th of July. And I don't think we didn't go back to the islands after the 4th of July, I don't believe, but we just didn't go back at all.
Can I ask a question? This is Sherry.
Okay.
Ray, when did you come? Because we have people coming and going from Charleston.
Yeah.
It was kind of like, let's go to Pineville for a vacation sort of thing,
yeah.
I think. But when did you come to Pineville to stay?
It was sometime after the 4th of July. So my guess is within a few days, I'm Ray Nelson, on the 4th of July. Because that really, that arrest and the really gave us a kind of cover. The NAACP was beginning to resent Blake and our presence with Blake, with the Young Turk. And so we just felt like this gave us an opportunity. Look, we've done what you wanted us to do. And it gave us an opportunity to say, okay, we can go now. So,
did you stay with us all that time?
After that arrest, and we just kind of, bailed. Everybody was furious with us. SCLC people were just furious with us, but we did what we could. You know, the situation was impossible. But we came to Pineville shortly after that and stayed pretty much. That's when Deke came aboard.
Okay. Let's skip to Newberry for a while. We'll let you guys rest. tell us about Mrs. Turner and Mrs. Epps.
Well, let me just sort of set the scene. Well, Newbury's about 40,000.
You are?
Oh, sorry, thank you, Tom. Bill Traynor. We somehow found Mrs. Turner's house. And she was very welcoming, and she was finding places for people to stay. Tom, I don't remember where you stayed. But Mark Nineberg was sent up to Whitmire to stay with Jackie Epps' family.
Mrs. Epps, yeah.
And then, so there was a committee. We were very fortunate compared to what I just heard about Charlie. We were very fortunate. There was a committee, and it was mostly the ministers of the in the town. And the most powerful guy in the county was, of course, the undertaker. He's the guy with the money. They had to keep him happy. But really, there was some of these ministers were like, you know, for perfectly decent people, etc. But really, Mrs. Turner was, and her sister, Jackie Epps' mother, was, that was pretty much the local leadership. Looking back, weren't we lucky? It's really all that complicated because the ministers really weren't that engaged. And, you know, I was staying in a house with Mrs. Turner, and, you know, so we didn't really, the group of five or six of us, by the way, we were all white excepting one guy, Fred, who was black.
Who I still think is a local, but we argue
about it. Yeah, anyway. We were in a positive way left on our own. And we had a little storefront thing behind the main street, you know, what most southern towns would be called the race street, the back door into the department stores and stuff. And we did a lot of canvassing. There were two women in the county from the American Friends Services Committee who were tutoring the black kids who were going to go to the white school come September. And so I got very involved with them also, and I actually wound up driving their school bus all over the county, among other things. So we did a lot of canvassing, and for Newbury County, I think that the background, the political background that was going on, actually was very important, not in the county but in the country. Because you had the Voting Rights Act going through Congress and all the publicity that was attendant with it, then the president signing the bill, and the Justice Department telling, now I don't even know what a U.S. attorney was at the time, but telling the U.S. attorneys, you will get compliance with this Voting Rights Act. So were you there, Joe? I don't remember. Tom, certainly the other people. August 4th, 5th, whenever the Voting Rights Act passed, the next day, it was market day. It was really a great because that meant a lot of people from the country came into town. And we got out there. Please, Tom, correct my memory on all this. We got out there, and you know, we just really beat the bushes all over this little town, and of course, they were all hearing this on TV and everything. It wasn't that we were such great organizers or anything. Mm-hmm. It was the news of the day, and we lined people, or they lined themselves up in front of the courthouse. The doors closed. It was really quite dramatic, and. I think about 350 people registered to vote that one day.
Wow.
And
this is the first Monday in August?
I thought it was a Saturday.
See, I don't remember the Board of Registrar's office being open on Saturday.
Well, maybe they were because maybe they were told they had to be open. I mean, this was a lot of top-down stuff was going on. We were just down at the county level, but
I'll pick up on that when you're ready.
Yes. So then, this was actually one of the most dramatic things that happened the whole summer. So there were the doors were closed. All these people were lined up. I ran a couple of blocks back to the office, got on the phone, and I had been given a number, I think by Richard Miles of the Voter Education Project, maybe by SCLC, I don't know. But I called this number, and I got through to the U.S. Attorney for South Carolina. Once again, I barely knew who that was, because they were on high alert from the headquarters of the Justice Department. You will deal with it. And I complained. I said, it's 8 o'clock. They didn't open up the doors, and we've got hundreds of people out here. And, man, you know, I'm sure a little hyperbole was mixed in there. And then I ran back, and the doors had been opened by then. Whether those two things are connected or not, I don't know, but I think so. So I would like to stop now and ask Tom's recollections of that particular event.
Okay, so Tom Rothschild, I want to go a little back. I think you've described the situation in terms of the local group that we were working with, which was pretty organized. I didn't interface particularly directly with the ministers and the undertaker and whoever else was dealing with the local white power structure. But the report that I had gotten earlier was that they didn't want any trouble in Newberry.
They being?
The white power structure. They did not want any trouble in Newberry. And I'll just give one little incident that kind of shows, maybe, the strength of that. There was one day where I was driving into the town, and I started to make a left turn in front of a cop, and the light was red. I just hadn't, you know, maybe it had just turned. I just remember it was a red light, and I hadn't noticed or whatever. So, I mean, that was a great opportunity, right? I could have been given a $100 ticket. I could have been arrested. All kinds of things could have happened. The cop tapped on my car with the baton as I was starting the turn and stopped me so that I did not make the left turn. He did not give me a ticket. He did not arrest me. And I think, although I have no way of knowing for sure, because obviously everybody knew what I was, who I was, and if he actually didn't happen to notice automatically, there was my car with Michigan plates on it, right?
Yeah.
So, exactly. I think they had their instructions. You don't create trouble if you don't have to. So that was created a very strong atmosphere, and that was the first piece.
Bill Trainer, go ahead.
Yeah. I'm finished with that piece.
I was just going to say I agree with you. I don't recall there's this one time where Omar Dinenberg was mugged, which we'll get to. But,
yeah, but that's a different
kind.
There's
up in Wigmire, up in Milltown. But in Newberry, I thought that the white people's, I will say it was a conscious strategy, basically ignored us. And, you know, that was pretty positive in those days. We were just ignored.
Yeah, I was the treasurer, and that meant I had a small account at the local bank, and so I had to go in there all the time. I was treated very professionally. I mean, it's clear they didn't particularly love me being there and having the account, but I had absolutely no problem dealing with the bank, putting money in and putting money out. And these are small amounts, right? It's not like it's a worthwhile banking transaction for them. Anyway, the other piece, though, of the white power structure not wanting to have any problems, as I understood it, was that we were told that if they could be convinced that this new act, which was pending in Congress, was going to apply and what its terms were, they would comply with it voluntarily. And so the question was, how do we get them to know that right away, because of course there's no internet, there's no fax, right? You can't just call, you just can't go online and look at the text and look at the list of counties and whatever. So what I did, and this was probably my biggest single contribution to the project, was I wrote first to my congressman, Adam Clayton Powell Jr., who never responded, and said, send me a text of the act. And when I couldn't get through to him, I wrote to Emanuel Seller from Brooklyn, and who was chairman of Ways and Means at that point, and I said, we need the actual official text that is going to be signed by the president. And at this point in the process, the actual text had been fixed, so it wasn't a question of there will be lots of amendments and changes. This was the text. And they mailed me a thick package, which was the entire Voting Rights Act, the actual text. And I gave that probably to Mrs. Turner, who brought it to the ministers, who brought it to the power structure, and they took that and they accepted it. And I think that was one reason, whether your call sped it up or not, I don't know, Bill, but that was one of the reasons why they opened the doors on that first day. And we did. We registered however many people.
I think it was about 350 people that right. one day.
And I remember on that one day that there was one elderly man who was in a wheelchair. He was a double amputee, I think. And he was in a wheelchair, and we carried him up the stairs of the courthouse so that he could register, which was something he never expected he would be able to do. And he, it was wonderful.
Bill Traynor, if I could just pile on to now that, you can. Wonderful story. I think there was an old guy in line who was practically blind, and he had been registered to vote when he was a kid.
Mm.
You know, when he was 21 or whatever. But of course, with Jim Crow, they kicked him off the rolls because he hadn't memorized the South Carolina Constitution or whatever, and he was re-registered. I remember that was a real heart warmer for me.
Yeah. And I think there were a lot of stories, Tom Rothschild again, like that, that we never heard even, and certainly that we don't remember from the people that were in that line. But that then continued that first day. Of course, there was a huge rush. After that, it was simply a question of convincing people to come in on whatever days the courthouse was open. And, of course, the people who were most eager had already registered. So it was a kind of a slow slog after that. But there was certainly no trouble. The registrars never tried to play any tricks or any games. You came in, you gave them your name, and you were registered.
And if you were illiterate, you made your mark.
And if you were illiterate, you made your mark. Exactly. So there was no fuss and games in Newbury. And it was, from that perspective, a wonderful place to be.
Bill Traynor again. Thanks to Mrs. Turner and the ministers. We, and Joe, you were probably involved in this also, we got invited to lots of church. In the summer, there's a lot of reunions where the people
revivals
would move north, they would come, the families would come back, and there would be a certain family reunion, church reunion kind of an event. And in addition to getting the best fried chicken of my life, we would then kind of work the crowds and some of these things, and then, of course, the Northerners were mixed in with the Southerners, and so the Northerners would say to their Southern relatives, oh, you've got to go register to vote. So I think that's how we reached a lot of people who probably never even came into town. They were probably 20 miles away or whatever. So, yeah, we had a nice, steady flow. Now, I don't really have any empirical evidence for this, but I was told by Jose and others that we had the most successful countywide scope project of the summer. Now, whoever went out and compared the data and whatever, I don't know. But I'm just passing along the praise that I got from Jose, and you know, I'd say I was on the staff, and they kept me on the staff, and I went off and did a bunch of other things. So I think they were very, very happy. We were almost sort of the poster boy project or whatever for the summer, because of course there were a lot of other places where, like you guys are talking about in Charleston. We were very fortunate, right. Very fortunate.
Tom Rothschild, one last, and so just to underscore, because of this arrangement that we had and because of the cooperation, whether happily or unhappily, of the white power structure, I think we actually registered the very first people who were ever registered under the Voting Rights Act in Newberry.
Well, if anybody beat us, they
would have been pretty hard.
They would have beat us by a minute or something, because it was the first morning that the Voting Rights Act was
in
law
effect
of the land.
Right.
If I might just come back for it, this is interesting footnote. So I called the U.S. attorney, I run back. The next day or so in the state with newspaper, there's a story about this big that says there was some trouble in Newberry and everything worked out fine, whatever. You know, the thing, 30 words, 40 words. Captain Howard Levy at Fort Jackson,
yeah.
South Carolina.
Another piece of the story.
From Brooklyn, a medical doctor, brand new to the Army. He saw the paragraph. Now, you know, he subscribed to the Marxist Review and whatever. No, anyway, so he gets in his car, drives up to Newberry, comes to the office, introduces himself. I had been in the Army for 3 years. So
which paragraph? I missed something in there.
In the newspaper itself,
yeah.
There was a tiny little item about voter registration in Newberry and the problems or whatever.
When?
The day afterwards.
Day after?
The day after the first day of the Voting Registration Act.
Okay, because Joe Freeman, I remember meeting Howard Levy before the Voting Rights Act passed. That's why.
I don't think you did.
Because I'd left Newberry by then.
Well,
and I met Captain Levy before I left Newberry.
Well, so
Tom Rothschild, I don't know if it was that item or something, but he had seen something or heard something in Columbia, which is where he was posted as an Army doctor.
Fort Jackson.
Or Fort Jackson. He lived in Columbia? Because I remember he drove from Columbia. So he had seen something. Maybe it was even something in the Army newspaper. I don't know. But whatever he saw, it enticed him to drive to Newberry, and he worked with us.
He walked in the office, introduced himself.
Yeah.
Maybe you were there, son.
I may have been. And he worked continually with us after.
Okay, well, so the reason
we're not for us.
Bill Trainer again, raises is that he then went on to refuse to train Green Beret medics, and he got court-martialed, sentenced to 2 years in Leavenworth.
Okay, we're going to go back to Charleston now, because that's a little...
Bruce Merrill, I'd like to ask something of the Pineville people, which is, we heard reports that you guys had been threatened. Mm-hmm. I heard a story about shotgun blasts fired at a house where people were staying. So clearly, I'd like to hear a little bit about Pineville, because where you were really under the classic kind of threat that we understood. So I'd like to hear some stories about Pineville.
You were there.
That's what I really want. Oh, this is Sherry Labitas, and I really want to... We need to talk, because I need to... Yeah. Update myself. But we had several experiences. One was a school about a block and a half from the Freedom House was set on fire by two white men in a pickup truck, and they were Molotov cocktails. And here we are. There are no fire hydrants in Pineville today either. We're trying to put out this fire with our the pans that we fix dinner with, kind of thing. And we called the fire department from St. Stephen, 5 miles away, and knowing they wouldn't come, but they did come with that big silver tank on the back. Oh my God, we're going to save the school. And so they ran out the hoses and they turned them on, and then they left. There was no water in the tank. And it ended it. So that got us SLED, the South Carolina
Law Enforcement Division. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And it got us the FBI because it was a school. And that was an interesting experience.
Yeah.
And the church, our main church, Redeemer Reformed Episcopal Church, had a service where they talked about loving and forgiving these white folks. And a week later, that church was burned. Same way.
We heard that. Mm-hmm.
And coming home from that church is when we got out of the car and we're starting across to go inside, and that's the shotgun blast. And then we had an experience in Monk's Corner, which was a county seat, and when we couldn't register voters because we couldn't get them there, because it was right at the end of August, we did do some direct action, and we went to, we split up into two groups. One group went to the Berkeley Hotel where there was a restaurant, and one group went to Howard's restaurant. And the group that went to Howard's was the one I was with, and we were locked out. We tried to get in before, but we were locked out. And we picketed, and then the white men arrived and surrounded us, so it was like this circle moving within this, anyway. And there were black people congregating here and white people congregating here, and we decided this wasn't an issue that was important anymore. And so we got in the car and we drove away. And we were followed. And we were literally one car, or a pickup truck behind, and I was driving, and a pickup truck would hit us and then back away, and hit us and back away. And so I'm putting on the brake and backing off. I mean, they don't make you know how to drive like that in California. And eventually our car quit periodically anyway. Oh, and then the other car pulled in front of us.
Right.
And we're going down the freeway like, or the two lane like that. And eventually I slammed on the brake. And as usual, the car quit. And so they beat on our car and they pulled out one lefty. And they beat him unconscious. And while we're doing that, the group that went to the Berkeley restaurant is allowed in. There, nobody did enough. They were not served, but they were in with no problem. And then there was a white man who took exception. And one by one, he threw them out. And the last one was Florence, the director of our project from Berkeley. And I went to the University
Florence.
Of Berkeley, too. The redhead from Australia.
Right.
And she was the last one he threw out, and he didn't open the door. So she went through the glass door. And now we get to find out what the hospital's like. And there was a black wing and a white wing. And the question was, what do you do with a white person? Right. Which wing? Mm-hmm. So they took her in the white wing, but the doctor came in, and there was a whole thing about where to put her. But when he finally came in, there was no anesthetic. I mean, she had some serious cuts. No anesthetic, no painkillers, no nothing. He just stitched her up and told her that if she came in again, she'd never leave. So that was, and we had, I know we I had forgotten about this totally. And then I go back to Pineville a lot, and I was talking to one of the kids, and he said, "Do you remember the night we outran the Klan?" I'm like, "No." He says, "Don't you remember? And we knew all the back roads, and that's how we got away." And then I don't remember that. But it was active, and the sheriff, when we originally went down in late June and said, "Here we are, and this is what we're doing," and he said, don't worry, you're going to be just fine. I will make sure nothing happens," which sounded like the experience you were talking about, that you'll mm-hmm. be taken care of. But when we finally went down after the church burning, he said, "Oh, my God. I said you should call if there was a problem. Don't come here." His name was Sheriff Hill. So maybe it would have been worse without him. I don't know. But that was our fireworks.
I also remember seeing a Klan poster. First
yes.
It's all there was a Klan meeting
yes.
in Berkeley County that somebody sent us on James Island. So we knew it was bad.
Sherry Levitas again. John Kimball, who was...
I remember John, too, sure.
...was one of the two older folks. He must have been all about 30. He went Betty. And they had the burning cross and the whole thing. But he laughed at it when he came back. So apparently it wasn't real. And we did drive-bys. After the second week, I think somebody was behind a tree writing down license plate numbers 24 hours a day. Were we still doing that when you came, Ray?
A lot of this, I'm not sure exactly what the chronology... I'm Ray Nelson. I'm not sure about the chronology of it, because they say some of these things about, especially the flow and the business with the hospital, I didn't know until I read it in your book.
Oh.
So,
thanks for the plug.
Okay. No, really, I there was a lot of things that had happened to you and Florence and the others that we just didn't know, and may have happened before we got there, or may have been something that you were involved in that we just weren't aware of.
Well, I'm kind of, Bill Trainer, I'm sort of sitting here counting my blessings that I was in Newberry, not in Berkeley, because we had one incident, which I'll describe briefly, up in Whitmire, which is a much smaller town than Newberry, and Newberry is not a big town, just a one mill town. Mark Dinerberg was up there staying with the family that Mrs. Turner's sister house, and he was walking down the street with Jackie Epps, and a couple of guys jumped out of a pickup truck and came over and beat him up pretty badly. He's got some scalp wounds, of course, bleed a lot, blood everywhere. So that was what Tom and I and Joe, if you were there, and then we were all, of course, 20 miles away in Newberry. To the best of my knowledge, that was the only violence of the summer, to the best of my knowledge.
In Newberry County.
Yes.
On James Island, we had probably a fairly unique experience because there was no civil rights vote on the island. There were hardly any whites on the island. The island was, at that time, was about 90% black. Mm-hmm. These were Sea Island plantations. After the Civil War, when the whites left, it was entirely black. There was one. The only whites on the island lived in a modern subdivision and were commuters into Charleston, which was 11 miles away. So we basically organized from the ground up. They were just ministers. They were the only people. And the person invited us was a minister, and then he got frightened about a white backlash. And there was a wonderful guy named Christopher Bright, who was a store owner from James Island, who'd moved to New York and lived in New York most of his life, and was politically active in the Republican Party, which then had African Americans. And he came back when he retired and bought a little store. And he was tough. He'd been in New York, and he wasn't going to take this Southern segregationist bullshit. So he became our sponsor and our champion, introduced us to people. So we just basically worked through the churches, and we set up a voter education school. We raised money at the churches. But we, other than once when John Allen and I were threatened by a guy just asking us what we're doing, kind of looking menacingly, but we didn't have any problem because we hardly saw a white person I used to get scared when I'd go into Charleston because there were white people around. And they were scary. But on James Island, it was just, it was this wonderful, rich, historic black community. And the sad postscript is that 10 years ago we had a reunion of the Edisto 13, who rested on the 4th of July. And my son was there, I had a rental car, and we drove around James Island and it was all gone. It had been annexed to the city of Charleston to increase the white voters. And it had Walmarts and subdivisions, and there was one tiny historic black fishing community left. We drove all around. Nothing was recognizable. Mm-hmm. And we'd had a very successful voter registration project, even raising money and hiring buses for the three days that the courthouse was open for registration each month. But that community was just gone. So,
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about local leadership, because I think we started on that and just skipped over it. Why don't you start on your both Charleston and
you mean, you mean Ray Nelson, you mean the, Ray, the folks who were...
Yeah, the folks you were working with, who gave you direction, who told you what to do.
Well...
Was there anyone?
Well, there was. In fact, there were a lot of people, and they each had something different to say. I felt like we really saw the complexity of the movement. It struck me as something very complex, and I think part of the reason that Charleston was just not as profitable in terms of voter registration as some of the rural areas were, was I think that there had already been a lot of voter registration. It's easy to organize an urban area. You go from house to house to house to house, and it's only, you know, five steps and you're to the next house. So I felt like that was sort of the Ward 4, where we were working, was kind of the low-hanging fruit for voter registration, and we met a lot of people who already registered to vote, unlike which was something in other areas. But the conflict of leadership and the conflict within the leadership, I thought, was illustrative of the different strategies of the movement. Voter registration was something that I could easily identify with, and I thought, boy, that's a peaceful thing. Who can object to that? And it was, but it was. It was just ordinary, kind of grinding, day-to-day politics. That's, you go door-to-door, and you knock on doors, and you register voters. That's how you do. And the strategy of direct action, of demonstrations, that sort of thing, sometimes came into conflict with that. And we were, in Charleston, we had to balance those two, mm-hmm. to keep from alienating either of these strategies. But I was always, the movement reminds me, the experience in Charleston reminds me of what I've heard about Troika, this Russian, you know, the horses all facing different directions, and yet the combination of the three goes in some way, you know, as it's directed. And I thought, this is the movement is a troika. All the leaders are going in different directions, and yet the movement goes along this way. So it was an education, I thought, very instructive. And one of the things that struck me most about the leadership in Charleston was that the political leadership took almost no role, or at least if I don't know whether they were simply standing aside and just kind of watching what happened there, but the party leadership there just had very little to contact with us.
Okay. About the white power structure?
No, the Democratic Party, the black precinct leaders and so forth.
The Black Democratic Party leadership.
Yeah, they just had no contact involved, which surprised me, because I thought of all people who would be invested in a voter registration project, they certainly would be.
Yeah.
But their absence was, I thought, something instructive. And it's just the complexity of it, I thought.
And Pineville was the same way, or?
No, Pineville was, this is where we're going. I mean, this is what we're going to do. I think, and like you were talking about
you,
I was on James Island.
I'm sure in the Beatus. And like he was talking about James Island, it seemed like an all-black community. I have since learned there were white people there, but we didn't see them unless they came by in the cars or they were burning things. So the closest we thought, well, I thought, what do I know? There was a minister at Redeemer Reformed Episcopal Church. His name was Isaac Gadsden, and his church was our main church and where we did most of the mass meetings. But we did go every Sunday to two or three churches. I was a foot soldier as opposed to Florence Jones and John Kimball, and they did the politics. So a lot of the meetings they went to, I only knew about when they came home. I was supposed to be working with the kids, and we also had a freedom school, and different people, and some of us worked there. I didn't. I was supposed to be walking. So that's what I did. It was interesting. We don't want you here, ministers. And one of them lived a couple blocks away. And so there were, especially men, there were people who didn't want us there because they were afraid. There were people who didn't want us there because they didn't like white people. But there were people, mostly ministers that we knew of, that didn't want us there because we were threatening the power they had in the community. And so when we, right after the time that we'd been shot at, they were thinking of maybe we'll move, instead of living here where we were at the Freedom House, we'll move them out into the community. And one Ishmael Prelo, No. Anyway, his last name was Prelo, and he was very clear and making it clear to everybody else we should not be allowed to live in homes, that it was dangerous to have us. And our group was three women and one man, the core group, which is kind of, I guess, unusual. I don't know. But so it was a case of, you want to have white women living with you? You really don't want to do that. Yeah. So we got pushback from them. And so there's the issue of taking away power by registering and voting.
So did the New Break Media leaders run into the same kind of problem?
I think the situation with Bill Traynor. Tom, I'm so glad you're keeping me on track here.
Yes.
Bill Traynor.
I'm not.
I think the situation in Newbury was different than the other two that have been described. There was this kind of a committee, ministers and Mrs. Turner, as far as I can remember. Okay. I would say that the ministers, obviously there was some variety in this, but they didn't really do much, but they did stay out of our way. And looking back, I was the SCLC staff guy, and I was the one who would be going to all these meetings or whatever. And looking back, I think that one of the terrific contributions that Mrs. Turner made was she ran interference for us. She was the blocker, okay? So if this stuff was going on like you described, you don't want any white women living in it. I don't know. Mrs. Turner wouldn't hear that stuff, okay? So
she was putting up white women.
Right. and so we had, I would say, in the context of the county, very broad sort of marching orders from the ministers, but really from Mrs. Turner. And they stayed out of our way. But I should point out, though, that we had a lot of local involvement, and this is one of the things I think is really under-reported or whatever about the whole civil rights movement. Our ability to do things was driven by the youth that we had involved. It was really, I spent my whole career in youth work. And this was for me some early youth work, And we had some really great teenagers, including Jackie Epps. We had really great teenagers, and they would do all kinds of things. And that's who, if you went into our office, there would be maybe Tom and me and whatever, and half a dozen of these kids. And they were out doing all sorts of things all the time. And they really were the most important part of the labor force of the door knocking and all of that. I just remember this one woman, teenager, probably 16, 17. Her mother worked in the kitchen at Newberry College. There's a college in Newberry County. Of course, it was segregated. And she, her mother had worked there for 30 years, and she had never been on the campus. In a little tiny town, she had never been on the campus. Later, they graduated the Atwater from Newberry College. You all know how.
What an honor.
How appropriate.
I mean, really, it was a blessing in that, you know, we had to work it out amongst ourselves, and Fred, this one, the only black, was a lot of trouble, let me tell you. He was a lot of trouble that had a lot to do with the young ladies, let's put it that way, a lot of trouble. And we were just basically just kept rolling, and nobody really bothered us, and we had good results. And for me, it was really quite a happy experience overall.